Great, thanks very much. Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to inflict my perspective on everyone in this group. So the organizers asked me to give a somewhat general talk where I would, I'll talk about some general questions that we need to address into this conference and this workshop in particular. So I'm not going to talk too much about the details of some of the recent work I've been doing. I will give a talk at this conference on some work I've done recently with Mike Douglas, which I might talk about a little bit in the context of this talk. But the main thing I want to focus on is this question, which is a pretty important question, which is, in string theory, capable of making predictions for particle physics? So I'm going to focus on the question of whether string theory can make predictions for field theory, for low energy effective field theory, and not so much about cosmology and stuff. Of course, the reason this question comes up is because of this landscape issue. But of course, people have known for decades that string theory has many, many vacua. And there's always been this feeling that eventually we're going to have to deal with this problem, that there's lots of vacua, we need to figure out which one corresponds to the real world. So what I want to do in this talk is to sort of give some of my perspective. I spent the last kind of year and a half or so thinking about string vacua, and I'm going to sort of present a point of view on this question and on the question of what we can do with all these vacua. I'm hoping to go through I'm going to try to go through what we understand about the space of vacua and how we might try to make predictions. I will propose a particular way of thinking about this, but part of the point of this talk is to generate discussion, arguments, comments, and sort of get things rolling for this workshop. So I really invite people to engage with this material by asking questions, throwing things at the speaker, grabbing the chalk, contradicting me when you wish, because obviously this is a kind of important thing to understand, and we all have different perspectives on it. So I'm going to start out by kind of running through some gross features of what we understand of string theory and the space of vacua. And I'll just summarize where I'm going to be ending up, which is basically with the following assertion, which is that I would argue that in the absence of a major breakthrough, and we'll talk about what kinds of major breakthroughs one might have, in the absence of a major breakthrough, if we continue with sort of string theory as usual, business as usual, the only way we're really going to be able to get a prediction is by finding correlations in the landscape, strong correlations, so that, to give you some sense of what I mean, take some parameter space. Here's a parameter space. You might think of this as the space of parameters for the coefficients in the standard model. Maybe you like the minimal supersymmetric standard model, some extension of the standard model. There's some parameter space. And what we would like to do is take as many string theory vacua as we can and compute as many of those parameters as we can and plot those things in the parameter space. And basically, if there are strong correlations, if these things obey some constraints, we may find that these things live on some subspace of codimension n greater than or equal to 1. If we can convincingly argue that that is the case, that all the string vacua that we know how to compute lead us to sets of parameters which lie in a constrained subspace of the total set of parameters, then I would argue we will claim that we can make a prediction. Right? We can predict that if you know some of the parameters, you can predict the others. And I think I will argue that in the absence of a fairly major breakthrough, it's going to be extremely hard to make any other kind of prediction for particle physics. So I'll talk about a couple things. I'll sort of run through what we know about string theory, what we know about the space of vacua, how we might hope to practically do a computation like this to make a prediction, and why it might be hard to make a prediction otherwise. So again, I invite lots of discussion from the audience. The main purpose of this talk is to kind of get things going and be provocative and talk about some of the general issues. So I'll try to frame things.
Vani, are you imagining that we can actually compute this hypersurface or this whatever the subspace is?
I'm imagining we can compute part of it. Part of the issue here is, what do we know how to compute? And I think part of the goal of the workshop for me is to understand, in the different concrete models of string vacua, how much can we compute, and how much is outside the range of computation. I'm not imagining that we're going to be able to right now to calculate every parameter in the standard model.
I guess I'm having some trouble understanding. I mean, both of the things that you said, I think, make sense.
Yes.
But I have no idea what the correlation is. I mean,
Well, the correlation is the fact that these parameters, let's say we have three parameters, right? Let's say one is the size of the gauge group, one is the number of matter fields, and one is some coupling, right? Or maybe take three continuous parameters, whatever you like. If these things, if you look at the space of all your string vacua, and you find that these three numbers are independently, uniformly, and independently distributed, they will fill this space according to some independent uniform distribution. Mm-hmm. There will be no correlation between those variables. They will not lie on a hypersurface. So the hypersurface is kind of an extreme version of a correlation. In this case, if it's, say, the coupling is a function of the other two variables, you know, let's say this is A, more generally, A, B, and C, if we can write C as a function of A and B, that's a correlation. It's saying that C is not independent of A and B.
I thought that you would be able to say something stronger, that if this is a hypersurface, then we can certainly predict that, you know, certain values will never be measured.
Absolutely.
I mean, before we even measure anything else.
You can say that certain combinations of A, B, and C will not be measured. That's right.
Even certain values of A will apparently. I mean,
depends on where the hypersurface lies.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the strongest versions of a correlation. It's a correlation which leads you to lie on a codimension and hyperspace. That is one which can definitively lead you to a prediction. The prediction is, string theory will never give you a combination of coupling constants, which is up here. Okay. If that's true and you measure that, then string theory is wrong.
It's more likely to be a fractal.
It is quite likely to be some kind of complicated space. But I think the point I want to make is we need to understand what that space looks like. Before we understand what that space looks like, all we can do is speculate. If we're really lucky, we may find that there are some regions which are not encountered. We may find that it's actually a very high codimension space, and we can make lots of predictions. Yes, please.
So in some versions of string vacua,
yes,
you have fields whose vacuum expectation bias are not determined to a very low energy scale.
That's right.
And if you look at an individual string vacuum, it takes you another year to sort out how the breaking goes, etc.
That's right.
How do you, I mean, as I understand it, you're going to look at the class of string theories where this doesn't happen. Because you want it all to be determined at the string scale or something.
I think in any given set of string vacuum, there will be some things that are determined and some things that are not. Let me go a little further into this before. I mean, in any given set of string vacuum,
it wasn't determined. I think it's right. Determined at a low scale.
Yes.
Are your techniques going to be able to look at that structure?
Sorry, maybe I don't understand your question. So you take a string vacuum. There's some.
Yeah. So you take a given string vacuum.
Good.
There are a lot of flat directions.
Okay. In general,
and
here
there is a whole series of symmetry breaking stages before you get to the low energy theory.
Good.
And analyzing that for one string vacuum is a major task.
It's true. However, there are classes of vacua, and I'll mention some of this work I've been doing recently with Mike Douglas, which is just one simple example of this. There are classes of vacua you can look at where you can analyze whole sets of vacua at once, and you can calculate these parameters.
Well, and I realize that, and that takes us to this morning's conversation.
Right.
So your proposal is to look at the classes of vacuum you can calculate.
Absolutely.
The other ones.
And the idea is the following. If we look at the ones we can calculate and we can't find any constraints, we already know we're in trouble.
Okay.
If we can find constraints, then we take several different, we take as many different sets of vacua as we can calculate and we try to match them up. I'm not saying that if we take one set of vacua and calculate, we're going to say, hey, we have a prediction. Let me go a little further with that. I think you need to be careful about when you think you have a prediction. But I think what I'm going to argue is that, I know what I'm going to argue is that this is really the only, from a somewhat hard-nosed point of view of what an actual prediction would be, and ignoring issues of anthropics and measures that we don't know how to calculate, I think this is the only way where we can really come up with a bona fide prediction from string theory without some huge large conceptual breakthrough. I'm all in favor of conceptual breakthroughs. I'm going to try to list some of the conceptual breakthroughs we need, but just assuming that we don't have one of those, what can we still hope to manage? And I think we haven't ruled out the possibility that string theory will make predictions of this nature. So I think it's worth investigating that possibility because it's something we can do with a finite amount of work.
Would you be happy with a less ambitious problem so that you want to look for predictions like this, not for string theory, but for a general transit partner?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, what I will argue is the first question I want to ask is, can you find any set of vacua where you can find any prediction? It doesn't have to match the real world, doesn't have to match, I mean, we don't yet have a good handle on any class of vacua where we can do this calculation convincingly and argue that for several different sets of string vacua you have a prediction. If we can find that, that will be evidence that string theory can make predictions. Then the question is, can it make a prediction for our world? Yes?
The only thing this really says, given the fact that we don't need it to go to engine because the data is all as a finite error.
Right, let me come to that.
So actually, given that, things are fuzzed out. So there's no mathematical meaning to go to engine. And because.
Well, actually, let me.
The only real meaning here is that there are regions of this space that this string theory isn't, if you want, dense.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I mean by the correlations.
So, therefore, wouldn't a better strategy be the Papa strategy of such a finding the swamp land? I mean, all you
sure.
have to do is find
it's the same problem. The problem of the swamp land is finding.
But you can just.
There you have to find the low energy. The question is actually the following. Which of the field theories in the swampland can be successfully looked into the UV? This is just supposed to give you a picture of where I'm going. Let me move on a little bit further, and then when I try to make a more concrete statement, I just wanted to kind of give a little preview of where things are going so we know where we're headed. So even trying to do any of these calculations with the spatial string vacua is a very problematic enterprise because we don't have any definition of string theory. Right. So let me just cover a couple points relevant to our ignorance of what string theory is, which I think are questions we have to try to address in moving forward. Solving these problems would amount to one of the significant breakthroughs that I was talking about. So first of all, we don't have a general non-perturbative definition of string theory. We have a definition of, we do it now, as of matrix theory and the ADS-CFT correspondence, have non-perturbative definitions of string theory in very special background, and that's great. It's a very nice thing, it allows us to learn many new things about quantum gravity. It doesn't allow us to go and compute these various vacuum points. You might think that the way to do this is, you need some equations, and you solve your equations, and then you just figure out where the points are. And the problems, a problem at this point, is we don't have a systematic way of writing down the equations of string theory because we don't know what string theory is. So we don't have a general non-perturbative definition. What we really need is a background independent definition of string theory. And people have searched for such a thing for many years. There's been a lot of progress in the last few years in string field theory, which is our most promising approach to background independent definition of theory. You might hope that with a good definition of string field theory, all possible closed string solutions could be written down as solutions of a well-defined set of equations, either classically or quantum mechanically, and imagine, at least hypothetically, putting on some computer and trying to approximate this set of solutions. We don't have a theory that's robust enough yet to do that. There was a lot of progress with Sen's work, which led to a lot of further work, better understanding open string field theory. So we have some sense of the classical landscape of open string fields. Recently, Okawa and Berkowitz and Spivak have developed a covariant closed string field theory for the heterotic theory. So there is some progress in this direction, but it's very far from the point where it's really a well-defined quantum theory where we can actually write down equations or anything like that. So it's an important direction for research, but we really don't know enough to address this program with it.
I assume there's been progress in existing the field string theory?
Yeah, actually, there's a very nice complete definition of a closed heterotic string field theory by Berkowitz, Nakawa, and Spivak in the last 2 years. They can do it at the classical level. It's interesting that, strangely, the type 2 theory doesn't admit the same kind of construction. But by using Berkowitz's kind of approach with the work that Nakawa and Spivak are doing, kind of tying it in with Barton's work on closed string field theory, you can actually construct a well-defined classical heterotic string field theory.
And that's a background independent?
It's background independent, at least locally. No one has yet shown in the same way that, for open string field theory, that there is the top of the hill and the tachyon vacuum, which are disjoint widely separated vacua, which are both realizing the same string field theory. No one's going to construct like that for the heteroid closed string field theory. But there is suggestive that similar things work. There is work on that. The ZN, missing the letters associated with it, but the standard closed string tachyon, APS, tachyon, Adams, Polchinski, and Silverstein tachyon has been studied in closed string theory in the bosonic theory and seems to indicate that this global background event is there. Probably the same thing is true with heteroid theory. So there's been progress. The problem is that you still have this infinite number of terms appearing in the action, which are, you know, always, it's still a big mess, but it's well defined at the classical level. Another important limitation in our current understanding is we don't know how to do even perturbative strings in Ramon-Vermon backgrounds. So most of the interesting vacua we know of, where all moduli are stabilized, include Ramon-Vermon fluxes, and we don't even know how to do perturbative string theory in those backgrounds. So it's really hard to try to do string calculations when we don't even know how to do string theory in the backgrounds we're interested in. Perhaps even worse than this is the problem of defining string theory in either the city, the sitter, or supersymmetry breaking backgrounds. Again, we don't have any idea really how to define even perturbative string theory in a de Sitter background or one where Sudi is completely broken. And since the backgrounds we're interested in, because the one we live in, are ones with a positive cosmological constant, this is some huge conceptual problem which we're going to have to solve to really be able to calculate every single string vacuum. Okay, so there's lots of things we don't know. The upshot of a lot of this ignorance, in particular, one upshot, is that there is no evidence at this point, I would say, for a dynamical selection of a vacuum. So, people say, I wasn't really cognizant at that time of what was going on, but people say that for some time there was a strong feeling that there was some dynamical selection mechanism of the correct vacuum. And it may well be the case that that's true, but we have not seen any hints at all yet of how that would work. Some interesting, promising research in the direction of some wave function of the universe along the lines of the OSV work might hope to give you some sense of how the wave function is distributed, but that also doesn't, in a natural way, at least as far as I understand it, seem to lead to anything that would give you dynamical selection of vacua, or a destabilization of some of the apparent vacua. So we really need a definition of string theory if we want to talk about dynamical principles, cosmology. If we want to rigorously talk about the complete set of solutions to the theory, we need some definition. We don't have it, and at this point, I'm going to leave this alone for the rest of the talk. I'm just going to say this is really important, but I think making progress in this direction would qualify as a really significant breakthrough. So I'm going to put this in my category of significant breakthroughs, and let's assume that that doesn't happen. What can we still do, even though we don't know what we're talking about, even though we don't know what string theory is? Yes.
Just one more thing.
Yeah.
When you draw this hypersurface, are you imagining that we should be able to really explicitly compute the properties of each individual vacuum? Or are you imagining that we might be able to not say anything specifically about individual vacuum, but still be able to predict that they have to form this sort of hypersurface?
Whichever thing you can do, it's great. I'm going to talk about a specific example where several dimensional subaxes, we can calculate some of the points. But if you can take either approach and get useful information about the distribution of vacua, I think that's good.
But the reason why you wouldn't want to appeal to individual vacua when you make your correlations is that you imagine that these are so dense that we wouldn't be able to distinguish which one we're in.
No, I mean, doing individual, I think, ideally you could do it for the individual vacua. You take 10 to the 10th vacua. You know, if there are 10 to the 10th vacua and they're actually distributed on a hypersurface, you know, a codimension 1 space in n dimensions, then you can pick that up pretty easily if you have enough data points, right? Even if it's a fairly convoluted surface, you're going to see that in the data. You don't need an infinite number, you just need some finite number. You'll see that there are open sets in this region which are not occupied, and there are other open sets which seem to contain things which look locally like.
What I'm trying to say is that if, even if things did not form a hypersurface and we didn't get lucky.
Yes.
If we're able to, you know, determine which particular vacuum win, then of course we can start making correlations, or at least if we can narrow it down.
Sure. So there's a distinction between the discretization issue. So let me actually come to that next, the discretization issue versus the general distribution issue. So exactly what you're saying is an important point, and that's actually related to the next set of things I was going to talk about. So let me...
The second remark seems unfortunate, but not in terms of the stabilization of that curve. We certainly don't think that all the things we find, the DS one, for example, are all stable.
There's a lot of supersymmetric vacuum.
Yeah, okay, so there are certainly classes of things.
No evidence that there's anything wrong with those.
Okay, so that one I'm fine with.
And presumably lots of those vacuum are in the low energy limit described by supersymmetric field theories, and it seems from things like controlling air cycle and chi that generically we may find that's it. But I'm not really just talking about
it. That's what you meant. But there's a blanket statement for the positive things, or surely lots of non-supersymmetric vacua are.
I guess what I mean is there's no destabilization of the generic vacua.
There's no destabilization beyond what you know from the hypercoupling.
Good.
That I agree with.
Beyond, that's the right way of saying. Thank you, David. There's no destabilization mechanism that we're really aware of. I mean, there are brain deviation processes for destabilization and things like that, but there's nothing which would make the large classes of vacuum that people talk about in the landscape all unstable by some new mechanism. That's kind of what I'm getting at. There's no evidence yet that the number of vacuum is order one. The number of quote unquote good vacuum is order one. Okay. So let's leave aside the fact that we don't know what string theory is. The next thing I want to talk about is the extent of the landscape. Steve, for you.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree, of course, that it's very important to understand what the underlying theory is, but there has been a philosophy that is, to a degree, justified. It needs to be better justified, but a large number of the vacua can be studied in the classical or semi-classical approximation, or the ten-dimensional. Supergravity approximation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it seems like we can get a lot of information here. We often do.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm going to do for the rest of this talk. I just wanted to, in advance, just point out that we don't really know how theory is. We don't really know what the theory is that we're calculating. And so it's difficult to do exact calculations, and it's difficult to know exactly where all the vacuum might lie, which is the next point I'll come to, and it's related to this lack of definition. So the next one I want to discuss is the fact that we really have a very poor understanding at this stage, I would say, of how big the landscape really is, right? We know that there are lots of, if we just start by restricting the supersymmetric vacua, we know that there are lots of Calabi-Yaus, but we don't even know whether the number of Calabi-Yau manifolds is finite or infinite. We know now that when you include more general things like fluxes, even if you restrict to the supersymmetric case, Calabi-Yaus are not the end of the story. Even in, without even going to M theory where you get G2 manifolds and things like that, just taking type 2 or other 10-dimensional string theories with fluxes, we need to generalize the space of manifolds. First of all, we get non-Kähler manifolds, things with geometric torsion. We even seem to get potentially worse things with some non-geometric structure, a specific kind of non-geometric structure, which is sort of a further generalization of the geometric torsion you get in non-Kähler manifolds. All kinds of rather drastically different objects might appear which are involved in these compactifications. And we really don't know how big the set of things we need to include is. And this is where Steve, it comes back to this question, what is the definition of the theory? If we knew what the definition of the theory was, we might hope to have some set of equations and say, these are the solutions of the theory, and therefore we know what they are. Up to now, we've been kind of limited by looking just at the space of geometric compactifications people understand.
Under the lamppost.
Right. People have been looking under the lamppost. Until recently, the lamppost was Calabi-Yaus. Now the lamppost is broadening its light to include non-Kähler manifolds, and now we're getting some hint that there might be other worse things.
There seems to be a Moore's law.
The size of the landscape increases by a power of 10 every 10 miles.
This is not what we lost.
The exponent gets an extra digit.
Yeah, so it's a little worrisome, this business. And if I have time at the very end, I'll talk a little bit about some recent work I've been doing with Jesse Shelton and Brian Weck, looking at specifically a bunch of potentially non-geometric compactifications, which seem to lead to good solutions, which dramatically might increase the number of things in the landscape. Another way of thinking about this question, so this is from sort of the top-down landscape point of view. What can you do to compactify string theory? There's another point of view, which Botha and Nima are coming to that, and others have been thinking about, which is the sort of swampland point of view, which is to think of rather from the point of view of the four-dimensional theory, which 4D theories lift to string theory. And so far the constraints, although there are constraints coming from unitarity and basic elements of field theory, we don't have very strong constraints on what kinds of four-dimensional effective theories can be lifted successfully to string theory. We don't know, for instance, of any picture like this where we can say, okay, this entire three-dimensional space is good in the language of effective field theories, but imposing that this comes from a string theory compactification cuts us down by k dimensions. We don't really know how to do that. This is all just discussing supersymmetric vacua. When we include non-SUSY vacua, our understanding is even poorer. Although there is a lot of recent work, like the work from Fogeter, Soderberg, and Shi from the 4D point of view, other work from the 10-dimensional point of view, suggesting that metastable non-supersymmetric vacua seem to be fairly generic. So all of this suggests that there are an awful lot of vacua, and the fact that we don't have yet any good mechanism for getting rid of them kind of forces us to accept that there may be a large number of vacua.
Why?
Yes.
Just very naively, why are we focusing on 4D?
No reason at all. Good question. Which effective field theories in any lower dimension might come from string theory? That's absolutely right. We want to look at the landscape of all the different dimensional theories and try to understand them. So, I would say, summarizing all this, the extent of the landscape right now is quite unknown. There's evidence that it's a lot bigger than what we've been looking at. And the consequence of this, I would say, is that a full sampling of the landscape is well out of reach. And that having a good enough understanding of what the space of string vacua is to claim that we were really doing a full sampling, either by sampling the entire space or by saying that we have a quote-unquote representative sample where you look in one corner and then you say the duality transformations mean that this maps it everywhere in the space of vacua. Getting to that point, I would say, would be another one of these significant breakthroughs. So I think it's certainly something we should try to do. We should do everything we can to make progress on this problem. But it's not an easy problem, and it's not one that we're going to solve by the time the LHC starts giving us data. So let's think about it. Let's try to understand this as best we can. I think this is, I've spent probably most of the last 10 years trying to understand all the different possible ways we've tried to define string field theory, matrix theory, et cetera. It's not at all clear that this is a problem we're going to make a lot of progress on in the coming decade. I think this problem we will make a lot of progress on, probably at this workshop and probably beyond it, but it's a hard problem. Carrying this a little bit further, I would say that right now there's no strong indication that the number of vacua is less than roughly 10 to the number of observable digits of information in the standard model or whatever your favorite model is. So this comes back to Raphael's question of discretization. Without a bound like this, it's going to be very hard to get any prediction by discretization. So I would take out of this discussion here the hypothesis that we will not get a prediction from discretization in the near future.
You say what you mean by discretization?
Yes. let's say there were 10 to the fifth vacua. Let's say there were 10 to the fifth vacua, and let's say we had 10 parameters. Okay, let's say we have 10 parameters and we have 10 to the 10th vacua. And let's say that they're not living on a hypersurface. Let's say they're sort of uniformly and independently distributed, but there are only 10 to the 10th of them. Right? So there's 10 to the 10th points in here. If we can measure our 10 parameters each to two digits, right, that gives us 20 digits of information. The 10 to the 10th vacuum will only give us 10 digits of information. Therefore, we will be able to predict the last 10 digits of, you know, we can figure out by matching 10 digits which vacuum we're in, and then we can predict the remaining 10 digits. So if the number of vacua is smaller than 10 to the power of the number of digits you can observe, even if the parameters of the model are independently and uniformly distributed, you can still make a prediction. Okay. So if we could show that the number of vacua is less than, I don't know, 10 to the 200 or something, we might hope, with a huge amount of work, to identify which vacuum we're in, and then by discretization effects, even if the parameters are distributed apparently uniformly, we'll start to predict digits after that. Right now, the point I'm making here is that the number of vacua could well be 10 to a very large multiple of the number of observed digits. And therefore, it might be, even in an ideal world where we can compute every parameter of the standard model to arbitrary precision from string theory, it may be difficult to make a prediction. So, I mean, this is the problem, this is why people worry about predictivity, that if there's enough vacua, you can tune all the parameters of your model to an arbitrary number of digits. And so this is just comparing the number of vacua to the number of vacua we need to fix things. And the only point I'm making here is that I don't think, without a significant breakthrough, we will be able to argue that discretization effect will give us a prediction. So this is part of the argument I'm making, that our real hope for a bona fide prediction from string theory without a breakthrough is going to have to be finding a correlation in that data. Okay. Any other? Any questions on this business of the extent of the landscape?
So this number of vacua is without putting any phenomenological input, like four dimensions?
That's correct. Here I didn't put in any phenomenological input, but you can tune a number of things. Let's say you tune to four dimensions. I would still say there's no evidence that it's less than this number of vacua.
I mean, I think this, you know, this is probably a realistic assessment, but I might be a little more optimistic on this front, just because there might be effects that push. So, for example, the cosmological constant verbs, I mean, the way you're counting, we're observing 123 digits.
Yes.
That kills off quite a lot in one go.
Sure does.
And if we can understand better cosmological selection effects, like which vacuum would we like to live in, maybe we want to minimize the cosmological constant for maximum amount of space and maximum complexity, then you know, you push yourself in a corner of this plot, and there, you know, the discretization might suddenly become visible.
It might. So let me say a little bit more in a little while about the cosmological constant, because I think that's obviously an important thing. Maybe we continue that a little further down.
I think the short answer, which I'm sure you're going to say more about, is that Raphael's question presumes that there's something that distinguishes states below cosmological constant.
Yeah.
What do you mean by distinguishing?
Well, we know the cosmological constant, but as far as we know, in most of the flux vacua that we look at, say the non-Suzy ones, cosmological constant is just sort of a random variable, reasonably uniformly distributed.
I'm certainly assuming that, yeah.
So the idea that you find the state, or a set of states with very small cosmological constant, is then a very challenging problem in this language.
I thought we're all assuming all along that we're capable of calculating the low energy properties of every single one of these vacua.
That's
a very strong assumption, but I thought that was the one that was being made.
Good. But there is an additional point
there. We have calculated to a very high order in perturbation theory as well.
I thought this was the game that we were playing. I'm sorry if I misunderstood that.
But even let's assume that we can calculate. Let's say we can take any given model and calculate the cosmological constant to a very high degree of precision. One comment which can be made, which is related to this work of Dennis and Douglas, which I think is really on the mark in this context, is that even if you can have a mechanism for calculating, if it is independently and uniformly distributed, and if it's independent of everything else, you're still going to need to look at 10 to the 120 vacua to find one which is small, unless there's some magic mathematics hidden in there. The search problem is a very hard one. So we can talk more about that later. It's not clear. I mean, absolutely, it would be great if some progress can be made in this direction. I'm kind of being conservative and pessimistic here, and I'm trying to say, can we still do anything interesting, even in the face of apparently a very difficult problem here? If you can solve a difficult problem, that's even better. I mean, the best solution would be if somebody can solve one of these problems, rule out most of the vacua, find a reason why we're pushed to one corner of parameter space. That would be great. They look like hard problems to me, but I think we should work on them.
I understand Raphael's question better, though. It's sort of like, is it possible that you suppose you could do that? You could isolate these vacua. Could it be that then the number of remaining things is not 10 to the, it's 10 to the 10 or something?
Yeah. I mean, I guess my working hypothesis would be that the cosmological constant is independent of other things. So here, the statement that we can't make predictions from discretization is basically assuming independent uniform distribution of everything, including the cosmological constant. Right, so what you're saying actually would amount to a correlation between the cosmological constant and other structures. So I think actually what you're saying would fit very naturally into what I'm saying. Right? There's no prediction from discretization assuming independent and uniform. So let's say we have 10 to the 500 vacua. Right? And if everything is independently and uniformly distributed, the cosmological constant will bring us down to 10 to the 380, and we're still in trouble. Unless there's a very strong correlation between the cosmological constant and other structure.
What I was presuming,
yes,
is that the cosmological constant is not determined by the Weinberg argument.
Yes.
But that for some reason, let's just suppose,
yes,
for some reason we are overwhelmingly likely to arise in a vacuum that's trying to have the smallest cosmological constant you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And then that could narrow things down more. It would tell you something about the size of the landscape.
So you're saying there's some selection mechanism which pushes us into a place where you have a very small cosmological constant.
Yeah.
So that would be good. That would solve this problem. I would say if there are 10 to the 500 vacua, then you would have to explain why the cosmological constant is not 10 to the minus 500.
Exactly. So if what I'm saying is right, there won't be 10 to the 500 vacua.
Right. Okay. So if what you're saying is correct, there will be a mechanism that pushes us to the smallest cosmological constant. So that problem would have a solution. This number would not be as bad as what I'm estimating it at. You're saying if this number is 10 to the 150, then maybe we're doing well. I absolutely agree with that. As of yet, I don't see any good argument why this number should be so small. The evidence seems to be indicating that it's much larger. Even just looking at supersymmetric vacua, you get a lot more than probably, you know, nobody's written them all down, but it looks like there are more than 10 to 100, more than 10 to 200 supersymmetric vacua, which are all discretized. But if what you're saying is true, it would be great. That would amount to saying that there actually are few enough of these that you could make a discretization.
I think almost no matter what, we're going to need to understand why we're not in a supersymmetric vacuum.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But I'm just going to take this more pragmatic point of view, where I'm going to say, okay, let's take a worst-case scenario where there really are 10 to 10,000 of these. Can we still do anything at all? Okay, so I'm just going to kind of wind my way through this by assuming that these things are as bad as they could be and we're not going to make progress on them. Obviously, everybody should try to solve the problem in a better way, but let's just see where we can get with that. Okay, so this is certainly one thing to think about. This extent of the landscape is another thing to think about, and if you can show that this is 10 to the 150, that's great. Okay.
I'm certainly not claiming that, that this is likely. I just wanted to shine a little ray of hope into your bleak.
I don't mean to be pessimistic here. I actually think that what I'm describing here is a good program of things to do. Okay, so what can we do if there are a huge number of vacua and we don't know what the theory is, and we do anything? Well, I think one thing we can do, which is essentially related to what people have been doing, but I want to try to codify it a little bit more, is to look for what I'll call correlations in corners. Okay. So we don't know what the full space of vacua is, and I think it's right now infeasible to even pretend to try to do a full sampling. So let's do what we can. Let's go to some corners where we know how to actually calculate things and find families of vacua. So let's find families of vacua where we can compute some things. So let's say that there are things we can compute. Let me call them X, Y, and Z. Maybe X is like the gauge group, Y is the matter structure, Z is the couplings.
What do you mean by corners?
Corners, I mean corners of M-theory moduli space. For instance, taking type 2 oriented folds with brains on them, intersecting brain models, or taking heterotic constructions with particular kinds of bundles. I mean corners of string theory, of the space of string theory vacua, right? Corners here is used very loosely, right? Here's the space of string theory vacua. We're going to look over here, and we're going to look over here.
How do you define those?
It's what we it's the things we know how to do. We're going to take all our lampposts, and we're going to shed the light on the lampposts. Here's lamppost number one. Here's lamppost number two. Okay, we're just going to look under all the lampposts we know about. We're going to go look under them and see what we find. And under each of those lampposts is a set of vacua. We know how to compute some things. And what I think is a useful thing to do is to try to systematically go and look under some of those lampposts and try to compute sets of things and look for constraints. Look for correlations between those variables. Right, so we take our X, Y, and Z, and we plot them, and we ask, do they lie on subspaces, do they lie on hypersurfaces, are there correlations between those data points, or are they, to all intents and purposes, independently and uniformly randomly distributed? Right, this is a question which I think is not really, even though people have done lots of constructions, most of the focus has been on constructing individual models which might match features of the standard model. And the point I want to make is that we may get more information by constructing classes of vacua than by constructing individual vacua. Not because of some anthropic argument. I mean, so again, Mike Douglas and I have been doing this recently for a class of intersecting brain models, and I think we have, you know, each our own motivations for doing this. But I would say that a motivation for doing this is not because you think you're going to get a distribution where you can then plug in anthropic arguments and an overall wave function of distribution of states from cosmology. It's really because if we can find a correlation, well, one reason is if we can find a correlation like this, it indicates that string theory is capable of producing predictions. Right? So,
that you're looking at very specific corners that might not be a generic.
Absolutely. Good. So what happens if you find a constraint? You look in one given corner. If you find a constraint, then you have to check another corner. And then you have to work harder because you have to find another corner where you can compute the same set of observables convincingly. Right? So if you get another corner, well, it sort of depends, actually. Just pragmatically, I would say the following. If you look in a corner and you make a prediction and the prediction matches something that's already been observed, then you just declare victory at that moment. But more likely, you're in some obscure corner of the string in space where it's not really a realistic model. You get some correlation in some supersymmetric model. You ask, is that really a prediction? The thing to do is to look in as different a corner as you can for something which gives rise to a set of models with the same parameters that you can compute, and you try to compute it again. And if you find that both of those sets of models give you the same constraint, and maybe you do it for three or four different corners, you find more and more evidence that different corners of string theory give you the same constraint. That's a hint that there's some underlying structure in the UV theory which is somehow constraining this thing to not allow certain values of the parameters.
Two would probably be declared as proof, right?
So you do this until, you know, with increasing degrees of accuracy until you feel you can make a prediction.
So what would be the type of prediction when we make the correlation?
The prediction would be something like if, let's say, these are three of the couplings in the standard model, you could make a prediction that X and Y took these values, Z, you know, maybe this curves around, but Z would only take these possible.
That's already a functional formula. Taking a function to some complicated random distribution is not something.
It depends on the structure of the correlation. Basically, I mean, the simplest way to make a prediction is if you can rule out large regions of the parameter space. You can say there are no data points here because of the way this distribution works.
But if you try to calculate the correlation, that would be a signature for counts on the input.
Yeah. Right. There are lots of ways of getting this. I mean, you know, one, there are numerous ways of using the information in this distribution to learn whether there are correlations, and then if there are correlations, to extract out of that whether that comes from a hypersurface or whether that comes from some general correlation between distributed freedom. And that's the statistics problem that you have to answer, depending on how this distribution eventually looks. So far, there's not a lot of distributions like this that have been computed, but I think as we try to compute some of these, we'll learn better what the right measures are for how to rule things out. But the point is, this is I believe a tractable program which we can do using existing technology, which could, if we are lucky, lead to eventually a prediction that certain combinations of coefficients can't happen. Of course, the worst case scenario is we keep doing this in different places and we keep finding that no, there are no constraints. And then we basically just need to, we need either a breakthrough of one of the kinds I've mentioned, or we need a bigger set of observables. Okay, so let me make some comments about this. Okay, so first of all, what are we trying to do here? I would say the first question to address is, are there predictions anywhere in the space of models? So what I mean here is, we don't necessarily need to immediately start by constructing something which is as realistic as possible, standard model with all the right matter content and all the right Yukawas and all those things. Instead, we can look at the simpler things that we can construct and ask, does string theory naturally give us distributions which have any correlations in them or not? Right? If it generally gives us distributions without correlations, there needs to be something kind of magical happening in our region of parameter space. If it generically gives us distributions with very strong correlations, we can be much more optimistic that wherever we're lying, we're also going to find those correlations, and we can get a qualitative sense of what kinds of predictions we might hope to make. Okay, so again, just to emphasize, I would say that following this program could lead to predictions, definitive bona fide predictions, without incorporating any anthropic reasoning, without necessarily incorporating any kind of distribution from cosmology that we don't understand. This could lead to predictions without a major breakthrough. Although, of course, we'd rather have a breakthrough. Doing this depends on constructing large ensembles of vacuum. And we should, as I was saying here, look under all the lampposts at our disposal at the sets of vacuum people know how to calculate. So there are intersecting grain models, which I've been working on because they're the easiest ones to actually calculate things. There are the heterotic models, which people have looked at for a long, long time, and I'm hoping to learn more about what people know how to compute at this workshop. So we can think about some more things here. There's the brains of singularities. People should look at all these different corners and try to understand this answer to this kind of question, I think. Another point which is related to this, which I think is worth making, is that I think that finding individual examples, so a lot of the effort in model building, I'm kind of a newcomer to this model building business, so people should assail me with corrections when I make statements that they disagree with, but it seems that finding individual examples of vacua which agree with certain features of the standard model may be somewhat less informative in this regard, at least if you're interested in making predictions. Right, if you want to make a prediction, given how many vacua we think there are, if somebody tells you, okay, there's a data point right here, which is pretty close to the standard model, it really doesn't tell you very much unless you know where the other neighboring points are and how they're distributed. Now, it may be that finding individual examples which look like the standard model may give some interesting suggestions of what we should see in four-dimensional physics. It may give you an idea of what to look for in an accelerator, new signatures, and things like that. It may be conceptually suggestive. But I don't think that it will really be able to lead to any quantitative predictions of the nature you might hope to find if you look at a distribution instead. Okay, any comments on that?
Don't you think it's a little dangerous to devalue the construction of concrete models when there doesn't really exist even a single concrete model that...
Sure, okay.
I mean, I would guess that if you had maybe three concrete models that were consistent with experiment, maybe you could see some suggestive correlation just among those that you could further explore.
I agree with what you just said. Also, I would say, since we really are just learning what we're doing, doing one concrete model, it's certainly valuable because doing one concrete model is a necessary prerequisite to doing 10 to the fifth concrete model. So, I mean, in trying to construct ensembles, you need to follow where people have already constructed individual models, and therefore, if you want to construct new lampposts, you need to find new places where you can construct a concrete model. So, absolutely, it's important to construct individual concrete models. I guess what I would say, though, is that once you've constructed a concrete model in a given region, I stand to be corrected here, it seems like refining that model by moving closer and closer to the standard model is a useful thing to do, but one should keep in mind while doing that how many choices one is making and how much one is refining the distribution that you're choosing that model from. Yeah, I guess all I'm saying is that as you're working towards finding a model which matches the standard model, it is worthwhile to keep in mind how your choice reflects the distribution in that volume. And that I guess all I'm saying is that you can add to what you can get by constructing individual models by also considering the nearby neighborhood and looking for structure in that set of data points. Yeah, so I don't mean in any way to denigrate individual model building. All I'm saying is if you broaden the scope and construct classes of models, you may get more information.
Right, Bill? The question just sort of brings back to me a worry that I had from the beginning, which is the actual task of computing all these points. Which mm-hmm. I mean, if you just wanted to compute one concrete model, it would have to have supersymmetry breaking at a TV, and the standard model would have to happen below, and yet you have to somehow have the computational power to actually know what's going on and have control.
Okay.
And I mean, presumably what you have in mind here is doing supersymmetric vacuum.
Absolutely. I would start with supersymmetric vacuum where you have greater control. And the
correlations that basically means that strictly speaking, you're eliminating all models that have any chance of being us.
Right. Well, we might be living in a model which has supersymmetry broken at a scale not much higher than TV, right? One could look at a class of models which would be valid at 10 TeV, which would be supersymmetric.
So then you're going to go after observables that are energy scales above the TeV.
You might.
And you expect those to be represented.
I would say the first question to ask is, are there any correlations in anything like the supersymmetric models that might reflect high energy physics? Because if we can't find correlations there, it's going to be hard to find correlations in a more realistic model. Right? If we can find strong correlations there, I think it's very indicative that we can refine our models by including Suzy breaking and including effects at lower energies and still find those correlations.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is when we eventually want to match up our own data with these predictions.
Yes.
As long as we're studying only supersymmetric vacuum, then presumably all data that are below a TV are useless for this?
Or? Eventually you need to include Suzy breaking. I'm just starting with what we can do more or less easily. Right. I think absolutely you want to carry out this program first for Suzy vacuum and then attempt to carry it through for non-Suzy vacuum.
Are you going to give us an example?
Yeah, let me give you an example. I've got only a few minutes left, so let me give you an example. And I'm just going to sort of summarize some of this here, and again, I'll talk about some of the details at a talk in the conference in a couple of weeks. So here's an example of the kind of thing I have in mind. And this is kind of part of the motivation for this work that Mike Douglas and I did. So let's look at the landscape of intersecting brain models. So these are not realistic models. It's a very simple class of supersymmetric models where I'm going to restrict to supersymmetric constructions. You have intersecting D-brains, and you get a gauge group, and you get some matter content.
and you can go on and calculate Yukawa's and other features of this supersymmetric model. So the reason I want to look at this is because it's simple to calculate, and it gives rise to quasi-realistic models where we can begin to look for some kind of correlations of the type I'm talking about. I'm not saying we're going to necessarily find the standard model in it with supersymmetry breaking, but it gets us in the right direction. So lots of people have worked on this, lots of people in the room, Marshall Simon Shu, others. In this work, they've identified something on the order of 10 regeneration models with the standard model gauge group. But again, so quasi-realistic models. You have a standard model gauge group, you have three generations of chiral matter, and so you have some examples of things that look somewhat like a standard model. So with Mike Douglas, we carried out a somewhat systematic analysis of this space of models on a particular orientable, just to get a sense of how this distribution looks. So one of the features of previous work is that people were focusing more on trying to understand individual model constructions, and it was not clear, for instance, whether there were a finite number of models in this category or an infinite number of models. So we managed to prove that there are a finite number of models. And using the tools that we used to prove finiteness, we were able to estimate the number of models with given gauge groups and the number of models with some gauge group UN1, UN2 goes as something like 1 over N1 squared and 2 squared, both U1, U2. And we found some efficient algorithms for generating all the models with a given gauge group and given numbers of chiral matter fields. We found the gauge group and the number of matter fields were essentially independently and uniformly distributed. So these are essentially independent and uniform. The point is we did not find strong correlations between those two features of the model. So
what kind of principles are this?
What's that?
What kind of principles?
This is the very popular one that everybody here has looked at when they look at these T-sec models. This is the standard one. Various groups, Svetich and Shu and Aranga and Kramanidis, Ibanez and Marchesano had constructed some of these particular models in this orientable. And what we're doing here is really looking at the space of all those things, bounding that space by proving finiteness. So that some other work by Lubenhagen et al., who were also looking at some of the statistics of this model, but they, again, didn't have a sense of how big the space of them was, so it was a little harder to get a sense of what the ratio were. But they had a nice paper, this one in a billion paper, where we're doing some analogous work and managed to give some very precise estimates for how many models have certain features. And essentially the result was that these two features, the gauge group and the number of generations of chiral matter, are almost completely independent and uniform. There's some very slight correlations, and the number of generations of matter fields is slightly suppressed if it's prime or not, doesn't have a lot of factors, but they're pretty much independent. So, yeah, here.
Sorry. You can put in as many brains as you want, I mean, I suppose. So when you say finiteness, you're fixing the number of brains.
There's a technical cancellation condition. So essentially what you're solving is you're solving a partition problem where you have a bunch of vectors and you're asking how many ways are there to sum that set of vectors to add up to a given number. And if all the vectors were positive in all directions, it would be clear there's a finite number. But some of the vectors have negative, they're vectors like this, which have negative coefficients in certain in different directions. So it's a little more tricky to prove that there's a finite number of ways of taking this set of vectors consistent with supersymmetry and adding them up through the partition problem.
That's going to come for moduli stabilization by fluxes and...
Okay, in this analysis, we did not stabilize moduli. We did not include fluxes. It's an important thing to include.
And strictly speaking, these are non-vacuum.
These are vacuum with moduli. The point was to do a first stab at getting some sense of what this kind of distribution looks like. Absolutely. So there's a lot of things that you want to do next, right? Let me just mention a few of the things we got out, and I'll go on to what you were just saying. So using this analysis, you can predict that the number of three-generation standard model gauge group models is something like between 10 and 100, which pretty well matches the number that were actually found. We didn't do an explicit search through the entire space, but it would be easy to do that given a bunch of computer time. We did do a partial search. We found two new models, so two new examples of quasi-realistic models here. But the point was really that as an exercise in this methodology of trying to understand what the distribution looks like and finding that these things really don't have any information in them. So we can't predict the gauge groups. We can't predict the number of...
What's the criterion for two different brackets to be different?
Sorry?
I mean, how do you know you can connect two different back here by just giving that to something?
Sure, absolutely. And so there's a couple of issues. One is these are actually points in a bigger... The intersecting grains, as you well know, are just points in a bigger moduli space. Right, there's a moduli space of open grain configurations. And really what you need to do to resolve this, and also what Matthew was asking about, the things you need to do are you need to include fluxes. So to make this a more realistic calculation, you need to include NSNS and RR fluxes. Those will induce a superpotential on that moduli space. And then the points you find would actually be isolated points that are extreme of that superpotential.
Yeah, but fluxes also change the spectrum of the brains.
Absolutely. It would be a totally different, I mean, this would be a harder problem. It's harder, as you guys found, solutions of the tadpole constraints when you include the fluxes, but it's much harder to solve the tadpole constraints with the fluxes included because of the quantization of the fluxes. So, an important problem is to include the fluxes, generalize to other orientifolds, I'm not claiming from this calculation that anything in particular about what we can predict. All I'm saying is this is an example of the kind of calculation you want to do, and you want to be systematically more and more realistic about it. You want to include the fluxes, which will stabilize not only the closed string, but also the open string moduli, so that these, it may not be just intersecting brain models. You may end up looking at generic brain configurations, which might have recombined brains. It might be an arbitrary point in the moduli space of brains living on that manifold. You want to include other orientifolds. And I think the part of the point is you want to start including other phenomenological data. You want to include the Yukawas. Etc. And I'm not claiming anybody to have carried out this program, I'm just saying this is the first step towards a systematic program of looking into this particular lamppost at a class of models and trying to see whether any correlations start to appear as you look at families and solutions to the supersymmetry equations. Right.
Yeah. Just while we're all listing our little complaints.
Sure.
To get from this to something like us, mm-hmm. You're saying it requires extra ingredients. I mean, one thing that I would also worry about is that when you break supersymmetry, don't you expect, because you're starting at lambda at a zero cosmological constant, don't you expect to generate a cosmological constant that's at the same scale as the supersymmetry breaking?
Generically, yes. So let me talk a little bit about the cosmological constant.
I would worry generally how representative any supersymmetric models are, especially with lambda equals zero.
Sure.
Because it's so hard to get from those to the real world.
I absolutely agree. I'm starting with the supersymmetric model because that's where we know how to compute something, and that's where we can look for parallelism.
Can we do something like this for ADS?
Yes.
With fluxes turned on.
Sure. Once you turn on fluxes, there should be classes of ADS back here with some very similar properties. And I think that should be explored. Let me say a little bit more about the cosmological constant. I'm kind of over time, so I don't want to go on indefinitely. But let me just say a little bit about the cosmological constant, because obviously it's really important. I don't actually have too much to say, but it's impossible in any model we know of to explicitly compute from string theory the cosmological constant in any of these. In any lambda greater than zero background. I mean, I think we would all agree on that. We don't know how to do that calculation. Given that, it is very hard to see how to really systematically bring the cosmological constant into this kind of analysis. I think it's something we would like to do.
Well, I think what I just said is what we're doing it. The fact that you can't compute it doesn't change the fact that we know for pretty sure that it's really hard to go from lambda equals zero to 10 to the minus 122.
Sure.
Right. We expect that really small numbers are going to come about by accidental cancellations.
Okay, but if we start in some ADS vacuum, that is your thing.
Yeah.
So here's some ADS vacuum. And generically, the vacuum we're going to be looking at when you include fluxes and run NSNS fluxes, include deep brains, generically, you're going to be in some ADS supersymmetric vacuum. So there are these you know, a bunch of proposals for how to lift ADS vacua up to DS, and...
And you can't compute it. I agree.
And you can't compute it. Yes. I agree that it's what we want.
All I'm trying to say is that there might be, if you start with an ADS vacuum with a generically large value of the cosmological constant, you're even though we can compute this, we know that very likely you're not as many steps away from the real thing as you are when you start with lambda equals zero.
So largely not large in absolute value, but close to zero.
Yeah. No. I mean large in absolute value. I mean, just generic.
So start with, maybe I'm going to try the same. Here's your, you're starting down here, very negative.
Yeah.
Okay, now what are you going to do?
Well, you add other stuff, anti-brain, the usual.
Yeah, okay, so you add plus stuff.
Yeah.
And this gets lifted up to here.
Accidentally. Whereas if you start with lambda equals zero and you add other stuff.
Right.
Then it's certainly not going to get lifted up to 10 to the minus 22 with just one extra ingredient.
I agree.
What is the difference between that and what you do? When you try to say that you lift it to a very small, but there will be all this contribution to the cosmological constant from the standard mode that will lift it up.
Yeah.
To the same time. Yeah. As long as you don't have supersymmetry. So it's the same.
So just say that.
So imagine you do what you're saying, that you just lift it from a transistor to something very small. It's still supersymmetry is broken, and it's broken badly. So
yeah.
There will be contributions to the standard from the standard model that will also lift it up. So
absolutely.
The problem is
no.
For both cases.
In this uplifting, I'm meaning to include everything.
Okay.
Sorry, you have to say that, Bill, you think...
All the way down to an electron ball.
Yeah, and it's going to have to accidentally...
How are you going to do that?
What, you mean compute it? I'm not going to compute it.
You're just telling him that, but you're telling him not to compute because he's trying to compute.
Yeah.
There's a balance right between you. He's taking something which is, and he doesn't care about realism. All he cares about is the fronting equation. All he cares about is well defined equation. And so the gap here is enormous.
Well, okay. Through everything I'm saying, I'm basically assuming that the cosmological constant is sort of uniformly and independently distributed from everything. So we could start with an ADS scale down here, and there would be some unlikely chance of having it come up to 10 to the minus 120 after corrections. We could start with an ADS down here, and there would be some unlikely chance of it coming up to 10 to the minus 120 with corrections. For a first stab at this, I would not worry about that, because I think that's harder than computing some of the features of the standard model.
Let's talk more about it afterwards.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I would start with the field theory and worry about the cosmological constant later, because I think it's a harder problem. You may be right that there's some way of dealing with it that would help, and so I'd like to talk more about it. Okay.
Isn't one way of saying what Rafael is saying is that, you know, he's sort of maybe assuming that if you were to solve a cosmological problem, you would reduce the number of acceptable vacuum to 100. Or 1,000, or whatever you regard as much too small to carry out this
problem. Yeah, if this number is 10 to the 123, then that's right, and that would be great. I'm kind of making the assumption that this number is 10 to the 10,000, and then we're going to look at families that are quite large, and we're just going to have to assume that the cosmological constant is independent. It would be great if what Brett Bell is saying is true, and that would make our lives a lot easier.
Okay, I'm saying something far more pedestrian. I'm just saying that if you start from a supersymmetric vacuum,
mm-hmm.
and you break supersymmetry,
mm-hmm.
and you're hoping that you accidentally end up with an extremely small cosmological constant.
I'm ignoring that, but go ahead.
Then I think it is, you know, you have a much better bet starting with an ADS vacuum than with a lambda equals zero vacuum.
I don't understand
that. Well, you may be calculation that you need to
add. It's just one fine-tuning condition.
You're assuming everything is positive.
No, I'm not assuming everything is positive.
No, then it's just the same calculation.
But I'm assuming that if that the supersymmetry breaking is going to induce a cosmological constant of order the supersymmetry breaking scale.
But it's not necessary. There's no reason it has to be positive.
Yeah, it could be correction.
So it doesn't have to be corrections. I mean, if you have some theory which breaks supersymmetry, generally, you know, you think about some effective field theory. Those are
okay. Yeah, you're saying that it could.
There's also a stop and a two sign.
Yeah. So you're saying all the contributions from supersymmetry breaking could accidentally cancel?
No, they don't have to cancel. They can be negative.
Well, we don't want them to be negative.
it's just as likely to get 10 to the minus 120 as it is if you start with a very small negative. I think it's all just.
Well, we're needing cancellations no matter what.
And I think the point is, I'm not trying
no,
to
I'm get, sorry, I think, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I'm not trying to identify the right vacuum. I'm sort of, in some sense, giving up on this in this discussion. I'm saying, okay, even if we can't identify the right vacuum, then can we still make some prediction which has to do with the fact that there's a systematic structure in the set of coefficients that come out in a coupling of some low-energy effective theory, which would probably be independent of the cosmological constant. But it's possible that some deep connection between those things, which would be interesting.
Another way of putting this, as much as I hate to fuck this language, is that you're looking for, the, at minimum, make a prediction in some other part of the theory.
At a minimum, yes. At a minimum, I would like that. If we can make that, with the idea that if we can make a prediction in some other part of the universe, then the odds are much better that when we really can do more detailed calculations, we'll be able to make a prediction here as well. But if we can't make a prediction even in some other part of the universe, it's really hard to imagine how we're ever going to make a prediction here.
So at the moment, you're going to choose that part of the universe that's easiest to calculate.
That's right. And then the goal would be to match on, to find ways that we, I mean, no matter what, we want to find parts of the meta-universe where we can calculate things and look more and more like the real world. And as we do that, we will be able to see whether we can make predictions in those successive things. But I think to answer the question of whether string theory can make a prediction, I think we don't need to check whether it can make a prediction here. We just need to check whether it can make a prediction in some world of instead of vacuum. That's kind of the point of right now. A1. Okay. I'm running a little over. Stop here. Question.
Yeah, I haven't even put a dumber question than anything else. Yes. I'm not sure I understood. Was the result of your experiment that there were no correlations of any kind? Or would you say, how am I going to interpret these numbers
as
the experiment we want to do?
In terms of the, okay, so we had a bunch of reasons for doing this, not just trying to address this idea, but in terms of this discussion I had here of predictivity, the only real result here is we looked at two different observables, the gauge group and the number of generations of chiral matter. And we found that those were essentially independently distributed. They were essentially uncorrelated. I mean, there's some slight correlation in the sense that the bigger the gauge group, the smaller the number of generations tends to be. Okay? There's a sort of distribution that comes out, and if you have a really big gauge group, you have a smaller width of the distribution. But there's no sense in which...
But there was some upper bound on both.
There's an upper bound on both. That's right. I mean, in general, there's a lot of extra U1 factors and hidden stuff that appear in here. There's a bunch of other interesting statements you can make. I'll try to...
Is there any, even if it's forgetting the fact that they're correlated, is there any kind of interesting feature of the distribution of number of generations, for example? Is it a peak, or is it just...
Yeah, so I can say a little bit about it. This is what the distribution of the gauge groups looks like. Basically, every time you have a U1, it's suppressed by some power of n, where the power is like between 2 and 5, roughly. Depending on what subset precisely you're looking at, there's lots of hidden U1s. If you look at the number of generations, the number of generations has some sort of rough-looking distribution like this, whose width goes with something like 1 over n to the 7th, where n is the biggest element of your gauge group. And the spikiness here comes from the fact that composite numbers are highly favored and numbers with few factors are suppressed. But this is like, you know, a factor of 2 here or something like this.
Sorry,
the width
seems to go to 0
very
quickly.
It does go to 0
very
quickly.
That means you have a prediction?
No, it means, I mean, this, sorry, look. There are, this is one particular, you have to ask, you know, how model independent is this? Right? For this particular model, we have some constants up here divided by a fairly high power of n. So if you had a gauge group of U37, you would be very unlikely to have very many generations of chiral matter. With 3 generations of chiral matter, even though the numbers should be small in this model, much smaller than on a general Calabi-Yau, where the numbers should be much bigger, you still have a width of about 100, because there's a really big number up there in the equator. So you have a width of about 100. You have a slight suppression of numbers with few factors. That just comes from the fact that in this particular model, the intersection numbers are products of 3 things. And if you have a number which is a product of 3 things, you're less likely to get a prime number than a composite number. I interpret that as being somewhat model-dependent. But this fine structure is very, very neat compared to the essential independence of these things. So there is a little fine structure, but I think most of it's kind of model-dependent, and I'm not going to tout it as being very interesting.
The total number of models was come to the level of the problems.
Yeah, in that order. Total number of models.
Okay. Any questions?
Actually, one. So, this isn't really directed to yourself, but the comment keeps coming up. In some sense, the thing, is it, am I correct if I interpret the, to say that when one, what was described as the swampland is really more or less the same program that you're describing, in the sense that what you're asking here is, are there regions where there's no population or very little population?
Yeah, that's essentially
right. You're looking on the, under the, I mean, you're looking at the same.
The method of approach is right. Well, there you start by trying to construct something that's unconstructible, and here he's trying to...
Yeah, but it has some similar features in the sense that it's... Well, the question you ask is somewhat different. I mean, it's phrased a little differently, but you also look under the lamp. I mean, a lot of the language that's used is a language of weakly coupled regions of modulized spaces and so on.
Right. It's stated in the most general way. It's a very similar statement between what I'm talking about here. Is, I mean, the swampland program could be in a very general way phrased as, look at all low energy effective field theories and ask which ones are going to give you completion.
Right.
To string theory or otherwise.
Right.
I mean, I'm particularly interested here in string theory. And I think what I'm trying to argue here is we can get information about that by doing explicit string constructions. I think the swampland program is in some sense equivalent to the landscape program, which is bottom up versus top down. And it's not clear how to, the general problem of deciding which four-dimensional effective theories can successfully be lifted is a really important open problem, which is at the heart of all this. And you can phrase it in different ways.
No questions? Thank you.